Hello, and thank you for joining us today on the Gentle Art of Crushing It show, where we focus on learning and sharing with our listeners all there is to know about how to create success in our lives. This show stands on the shoulders of giants. Our mission is to empower and inspire our listeners to create the life of their dreams whilst having a blast in the process. Let's celebrate life together. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the Gentle Art of Crushing It podcast. My name's Randy Smith, and this is brought to you live in Salt Lake City from the Best Ever Conference podcast stage, sponsored by Pre-iShare. So welcome to the show. Really, really excited to have three of my partners with Impact Equity here today. These are what I consider some of the most elite operators in the space for passive investors. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in this space today. So why don't each of you guys kind of introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about yourself, the companies, and your secret sauce, what you bring to the table. So Zach, you want to kick us off?
Yeah. Thanks so much, Randy, for having us on. You know, you're obviously a great partner with us. You know, Sam and I partnered together on a bunch of deals and been a friend with Rob here. So really, really excited to be here. But yeah, so I'm Zach Habensall, the CEO and co-founder of Rise 40 Equity. You know, we just do value-add multifamily. So we're in Phoenix and Dallas, buying existing cash-flowing deals, renovating them, increasing the rents, and then looking to sell. So that's our focus.
Awesome. Thanks, Zach. Rob?
Yeah, so we're very similar. We're a multifamily firm based in New York, but focused exclusively on Texas workforce housing. I think similar to Rise and Zach, we have a focused strategy, which is really, you know, built our success. We've just only stuck to value-add deals in Texas. It's allowed us to vertically integrate and really uncover the best opportunities for our investors.
Love it. Awesome. And Sam?
So we're a bit different. We focus in the short-term rental space, and we are national in scope. So for us, our big thesis there is that single-family homes are a mispriced asset class. Currently, they trade on comparison value, right? Square footage, finishes, location, where our thesis is that they'll start trading like every other asset class based on the cap rate. So we're nationally to go help combat seasonality between the markets that we're in.
Fantastic. All right. So we've got a bunch of, or three guys here that are bringing a ton of value, leveraging various value add strategies. So I'd love if we can to dig into that to hear how you guys are driving value and creating value for the investors. So Sam, why don't you start us off if you can?
Yeah, so when looking at the short-term rental space, a big thing that we do is converting properties. So most properties are an existing 3 or 4 bedroom. We're actually going in and adding intrinsic value through adding an extra bedroom, extra bathroom, right, amenitizing the property. So forcing appreciation in terms of the actual single-family home value price, but more so looking to go convert that to a business in the short-term rental space. So renting all the properties on nightly, multiple night type stays, then looking to go roll those up and exit them at a cap rate. Where we really feel like we're adding a lot of value is the 1, design of the property, 2, construction of the property, and 3, the management. And also the longer term play of aggregating the full portfolio and looking to go exit to an institutional buyer in the future.
Okay.
As institutions typically either build or buy. In this space right now, there's not a lot of appetite to go build. So we feel as though we have a moat in terms of being one of the premier portfolio builders to exit them, the future for them to go buy.
I love it. And so your assets, they look very, very different than most of the other short-term rentals out there. And I think that's probably what differentiates you. So can you talk a little bit about your amenity process and when you see an asset, how you create the vision for that to create, you know, the rents that you're getting, the average daily rents and the occupancy that you're getting?
Luckily, we have people who are way better at that than myself. We
sure
do it. But a big thing we have is we have a head of data science internally who actually, him and our head of acquisitions, their sole job is when we find properties, 1, making sure they hit our basic metrics of return profile, but 2, really figuring out who the guest avatar is who's staying there. For example, one of our big markets that I know Zach's familiar with is Phoenix, right? So for us there, we understand that 2 things matter a lot. Right, heads and beds in terms of how many people we can sleep in a property, and also the amenities. People will go visit there for golf trips, bachelor parties, corporate events, bachelorette parties, and they're really focused on what's the experience of that house. So for example, that's our highest spend in a backyard. I know you're actually at one of the houses we did a few months back where, you know, pool, hot tub, basketball court, pickleball court, bowling, all these games outside. So people can actually use these houses as a full destination to go to, regardless of where the area is itself. So really focusing on who the end avatar is as the guest in that given area.
You guys do an amazing job, and anybody that's seen the properties can tell the quality. Like, almost every square inch of that property is maximized for family enjoyment and revenue generation. So great job. So Rob, let's shift gears a little bit and jump into multifamily. Value add is something you hear a lot of people throw around, and people think about the classic, you know, paint and lipstick value add. But can you talk about what Lone Star is doing unique in the market to drive value?
Yeah, I think to my earlier point about focus, I think it's also important not to walk around with a hammer in your hand and thinking everything's a nail. It's important to have multiple tools in your tool belt. And for us, we have different ways that we look at deals. So we've bought older properties, like even 60s and 70s vintage assets, but we've also purchased properties in the 2000s and even in the 2000 up to 2020 vintage. Mm-hmm. Those are very different types of deals where you're going to approach the business plan very differently.
Yep.
Specifically, right, older deals, they need a heavier lift. You're going to have to invest more into the property. You probably have crime mitigation that you need to work on. There's deferred maintenance on the interior and the exterior. Whereas when you're looking at a newer vintage asset, you're more so looking to potentially solve for lower returns with lower risk, and then finding ancillary ways to enhance revenue, such as bulk internet. We've really been enjoying smart home tech packages, carports, and things like that. So you have to get more creative, but at the end of the day, it's really more of a basis play and not of a quick flip, if you will.
Sure.
And then finally, for us, something very unique to our firm are our tax and affordable housing strategies, which I am a huge fan of. And these are more complex things that have taken us years to develop, relationships that have taken years to build. But what it does is it allows us to do public-private partnerships or nonprofit partnerships, which result in 50% or 100% long-enduring property tax exemptions, which the reason why I love them so much is because we are, number one, creating a public benefit. But number two, we're able to solve for value-add-like returns, so mid-teen IRR returns, while taking, in my opinion, much less risk than your conventional lipstick value-add that you mentioned, because we're actually holding rents steady or even decreasing rents in many circumstances to achieve the returns, which is obviously quite opposite to trying to push rents $100, $200 to achieve your returns.
Yeah. No, and it's proven very effective, especially in the last 18 months or so, where a lot of operators are struggling with deal flow. You guys have been able to adjust to the changes in the market and really identify additional strategies to drive value, as always. So let's move to Zach. Like, Zach, you guys don't have a deal flow issue. You guys, well, from our optics, you don't, because we see a lot of deals coming. So let's talk about, you know, the Rise 48 way and what you guys do to drive value, which has been pretty much cookie cutter, it looks like, from day one, and you've just refined your process over and over and over again. So let's hear about that.
Yeah, thanks, Randy. Yeah, I tell people we're kind of like a vanilla company. Like, we stick to our box and just rinse and repeat. And so, you know, we're looking for B-class assets in A and B locations, so primarily 1980s, 1990s vintage assets where at least 100-plus units. You know, these deals are typically 85 to 100% physically occupied when we buy them. So they're cash flowing day one, you know, covering operating expenses, debt service, boosting cash flow to investors. And for every single deal, we'll go in there on the exterior and just completely rebrand the asset. Okay, so we do the same exact monument sign with an LED backlight, just helps the curb appeal, leasing activity, same three-tone exterior paint scheme, a lot of amenities like a fitness center, dog park, playground. And then on the interiors, you know, we do a very high-level interior scope. So we basically will gut that unit down, and we do brand new gray vinyl plank flooring, quartz countertops, undermount sinks, subway tile backsplash, stainless steel appliances, brand new boxes. And so we've structured the entire company around this business plan. And that goes from our supply chain. We buy our materials directly overseas from a wholesale manufacturer at fixed pricing. You know, we have our own construction management company, property management. We structure the debt to really align with this business plan. We can go in there and renovate these units and add the value. And so, you know, we've renovated several thousands of units the last few years. We've renovated over 1,900 units just last year. So we've kind of, you know, we found what works for us. You know, and it's kind of like if it's not broke, don't fix it type of deal.
Yep.
You know, and so we just kind of stick to our box. And I was just talking to Rob earlier. Sometimes we see other deals that are attractive. Like, oh, this, we can make a good deal here. This looks like a really good area. But we have to try to stay disciplined because we know that we've kind of built the systems for what we do. And we just kind of crank crank that model over and over.
Sure. Yeah, and maybe there could be some deal sharing here as you guys come across to others as well, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Well, you mentioned a really important piece, debt. And I think actually I heard you, Rob, share this on a stage one day, is that the number one risk in this type of investment is debt. So, Zach, let's jump into that. You guys have been tried and true with your debt strategy. Can you talk about that strategy, why you chose it, and why you continue to use that strategy in today's market?
Yeah, 100%. So we're taking like 55 to 65% loan to value loans. And these are basically, go ahead.
Can you jump in and talk to why that's so important as well?
Yeah.
Because that's a big piece, right?
100%. And so interest rates have skyrocketed, right? Really 24 months ago or so. And a lot of groups that are in trouble took highly leveraged loans, like 80% plus leverage, okay? You know, the highest leverage we ever took was like 75% loan to value, meaning you have a 25% cash down payment. Well, ever since summer of 22, our deals are between like 55 to 65% loan to value. So they're lower leverage loans where you have a bigger cash down payment. And historically, we've done a variety of like 10-year Freddie Mac fixed. We've done 10-year Freddie Mac floating, and we've done debt fund bridge loans, okay? So we know, and we've sold all those types of loan products. So we know the pros and the cons upon acquisition, through operations and disposition. And for our value add strategy, you know, we feel confident we can increase the value and then do a sale or a refinance. And so two of our very first deals, we did 10-year Freddie Mac fixed rate debt, and we got hit with a really nasty yield maintenance prepay penalty.
Yep.
Okay, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I mean, I think that there are certain business plans where fixed rate makes sense. And for our business plan, we just don't think it makes the most sense because it bit a big chunk out of our returns to our investors. And we were fortunate the market was strong, so we could still sell and hit like over a 2x multiple. But if we were to do that today, we'd be stuck in that loan. We wouldn't be able to sell. So basically, you could ace your business plan, do a great job, and you go to try to sell a refi, and we feel like that prepay penalty can just kind of wipe out a lot of the value that we've created.
Yep.
So if you're going to do like a little bit longer term hold and more of a yield play, I think that makes sense. The reason we do floating rate debt is these floating rates don't have a prepay penalty. Okay, so we can underwrite that into our model. And we can basically determine, okay, if I want to refi or sell in year 2 through 5, I can do whatever makes the most sense at that moment in the market. But we mitigate against the floating interest rate by buying low in the money interest rate caps. Okay, so I'm basically buying a 3-year cap upfront where my max all-in rate is 4.75% day one.
Yep.
And so we're effectively engineering a 3-year fixed rate loan. Okay, and then in the model, we're making sure that by the end of year 3, our NOI and DSCR are high enough so that if rates have not come down 36 months from now, we feel confident I can refinance into an agency loan by the end of year 3. So it gives me a lot of flexibility where, you know, by the end of year 3, I can refi. If for some reason I don't want to refi or can't, I can extend the loan term and I have a lot of reserves to buy a new cap. Or I could sell the deal by the end of year 3. We don't bank on that in the model, but if it makes sense to do that. And so we've had to adjust because we bought a number of deals at the end of 21 and early 2022, which in hindsight were at the peak of the market. Okay. And at that point, we were buying caps that were like 5.5 to 6.5% all in, right? And at the time, our rate was like low 3s. And in the model, we were assuming rates would increase 1 to 2% in the first 2 years, which was more conservative than Chatham Financial and all these forward-looking curves. So we felt like we were covered. Well, after March of 2022, rates skyrocket. You know, in a matter of months, my debt service goes from 3% up to 6% or 6.5% of some of these deals. And all those 2021 deals immediately go into negative cash flow, right? So we're like, oh, crap, we need to now increase the velocity of renovations and force appreciation. And we've gotten the majority of the 21 deals back to positive cash flow. And they should all be there by the end of this year.
Yep.
And so it was kind of a testament to that. But we learned after that second hike in May of 22, we had to adjust our underwriting to take lower leverage, buy a lower, tighter cap. So I have positive cash flow day one at my max cap, and then have even more reserves. So that's how we've looked at it. And that's kind of how we structure the debt.
I think if we had a crystal ball back at the end of 21, 22, that might've been a different strategy, but nobody in the marketplace had any idea that this was going to happen. So it's nice to see new deals that are coming out that are cash flowing day one. You guys do raise significant reserves as well, which thank goodness you do, because there are a lot of operators out there that that talked against that strategy back in 21 and early 22. And I, as an investor, am very glad that you have the reserves that you do. And yes, we had some diluted IRR potentially, but it's minimal, if anything, when you really look at the end result. So now, Rob, you guys take a slightly different strategy here. And I appreciate, Zach, that you said there's not a right or wrong strategy here. It really aligns with the business plan. And Rob, to your point, you have a different strategy and it aligns with your business plan. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think to both of your points, the most important thing in a deal is that everything is in alignment. And we were actually just talking with Zach a minute ago about he'll change up his debt structure if it's what investors want, right? So he's just catering to what his investors want, and then that flows through to the debt structure, to the business plan, and the deal profile. And I think it's true, it's the same thing. For us, we need to make sure that our investor goals are in alignment with the type of deal we're buying, and that's in alignment with the business plan, right? You don't want to go and do a heavy value add on a 2022 vintage deal. That's pretty obvious, right? That doesn't make sense. So business plan, deal, debt, all need to be in alignment in order to fulfill the goal of the investor. And so for us, our goal is obviously very similar to everyone here. It's to create great returns for our investors. But something else that we want is we want to create a smooth experience for our investors. Like Zach, we've had experience with bridge debt. We've had experience with 10-year fixed, 10-year float. So we've done many different debt structures. And we feel like the goal, the long-term vision for our company is to build the smoothest business. I want to sleep like a baby at night. More importantly, I want our investors to sleep well at night. We know that we're not just delivering a financial return to our investors. We're delivering much more than that. We're delivering an experience. And that experience, we want to be a good one. Mm-hmm. And for us, we feel like doing a lower risk debt profile that's fixed rate, we give up some of the upside that Rise 48 is able to capture through being more opportunistic and aggressive with their renovation programs. But we feel like, you know, we don't want to compete in that space. We want to find good deals and we want to make sense of them over a 5-year period. If we can exit sooner, we'll eat the prepay and we'll still have a great return for investors. Yeah. But that's kind of, you know, a little more passive approach, if you will.
Sure. No, and it's interesting being sitting from the impact equity standpoint and trying to present alternatives to my investor to match the avatar needs. Some are more cash flow investors and some are more equity play or appreciation play. So to be able to present two operators with two very different business plans, two very different debt structures, it allows me to give investors, if they're looking for cash flow, I'm leaning on multifamily with Rob. If they're looking for appreciation, I'm leaning on Zach and his team for their strategies. So now kind of a blend of the two is, and that's, you know, partly why we brought on with Impact Equity TechVestor and their strategy. They're a cash flow and an equity play. And you guys leverage some unique debt structures as well. Very different, obviously, a different asset class. But can you tell the audience the type of debt you're using and why you're using it in that space?
We use all of our debt products are commercial loans that are DSCR loans. So they are measured based on what the projected revenue is of that property. And then usually some small haircut based on whether it be AirDNA. But a nice thing now is that in the markets that we're biggest in, we own 30, 40 comps in those areas. So we've built credibility with those lenders where we can go use our own properties as comps. And for us, all of our loans that we've taken out since inception are at least 10 years fixed. Most of our loans in 21 and 22 were 10 years IO, interest only, where those rates were not much more than 30-year principal interest. Now, almost all of our loans in 2023 and 2024 are 30-year principal interest. We've seen those spreads go up by about 100 basis points, where the actual net cash flow to investors is nominal in terms of a spread. So for us, our biggest risk in the SCR asset class is that it's more unproven than value multifamily, right? Or core plus multifamily. And for us, our biggest risk is, instead of being a 5-year hold, maybe it's 7, maybe it's 10. Because we have to partially wait for the market to go form. Why I believe we actually have a big opportunity is the market hasn't fully formed yet as to who buys these portfolios of properties.
Sure.
So on our end, we want to be very conservative and make sure that we can hang on to properties as long as we have to for that market to go form. Also, the nice thing too is that all of our debt is fixed, right? And we have good relationships with those lenders.
No surprises, right?
Yeah.
No surprises at all. Yep.
And our DSCR across portfolio today hovers around 3x, which you don't see multifamily very often at all.
Yeah.
And obviously there is more variance to it. And we also knew too in the space that people we've talked to about potential purchases, in multi you can get away with a T3, T12. In our space, it's more of a T36. They want to see 3 years at least of data showing you performed this and you've also kept it up. As we know, year to year, numbers can change in space.
Interesting.
So we want to make sure we can go ride out any type of down period and also still be very predictable to investors in cash flow once stabilized.
Awesome. Awesome. So three very different strategies, all very appropriate for the business plans and for the economy that you're in, and match differently with the investor avatar that's looking for different type of returns. So now I know, Zach, you've got to leave the little stage and move over to the big stage here. I'm going to stay on with Sam and Rob and talk about a couple of things, but if before you leave, if you could give maybe one bit of advice to the passive investor, and we'll come back to you guys later on this, about how they should look at this space and maybe a strategy that you might suggest to the new passive investor that's coming into the space.
Yeah, no, I think this was a great panel, Randy, because I think the investor needs to determine what is their goal, right? I mean, you've got three different investment strategies here, and obviously they're all great. That's why you're working with three different operators.
Yeah.
So I think it's first identify the strategy, right? What type of asset class, what type of strategy do you want to do within that asset class? But then vet the operator, right? There's the cliching, it's the jockey, not the horse or whatever, right? So it's the operator who's going to execute the plan. You're never going to see a deal that has a bad looking pro forma, right? You're not going to look at deck that's you're not going to see a deck with bad returns and say this deal sucks, right?
Sure.
They're always going to look good. So is it the track record and the ability to execute on that plan is the biggest thing for LPs to look at, I think.
Awesome. And before you go, how could folks find you or more about Rise 48?
Thanks, Randy. You guys can just go to our website, rise48equity.com. You can email me at zach@rise48equity.com, set up a call with me, and look forward to talking to anybody.
Awesome. Thanks, Zach.
Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it, Randy. Thank you.
All right. So coming back to you guys, let's continue the conversation if we can. Let's talk going back to that question that I finished with Zach, can you talk to maybe some advice that you're giving new or newer passive investors, or even a new passive investor to you, strategies that they might consider when coming into the space? And Rob, we'll start with you.
I think a common notion when people get started is diversification. I need to meet 20 operators and I need to invest in 50 deals. And I think diversification is very important, and that is a great way to achieve success. So if you have, you know, one bad apple, you're not busted, right?
Yep.
However, I think people end up diversifying because they have this, like I said, this notion to meet a ton of sponsors. And this is very self-serving to say, but I think actually the fewer sponsors you work with, the better results you're likely to get. Like Zach just said, if you focus on going deeper with a sponsor, really vetting them, getting comfortable with them, it's going to do a few things. One, it's going to really provide you more insight rather than just throwing out a random bet on testing a flyer on someone, right?
Right.
But then the other thing it's going to do is it provides this comfort that allows you to be passive, right? Passive investing is supposed to be passive. You don't want to have to do background checks on the sponsor every single time you do a deal, right? You want to get comfortable with their operation, with who they are as a person, know that they're going to take care of you and it's a relationship in good times and bad, and that you don't have to underwrite the deal every time a new one comes, right? I'm not saying that you should just blindly invest, obviously, right? But the value of a relationship like that is one where you can be passive as an investor. You have that trust and you can invest and you don't have to spend hours and hours having a second job.
I love that. Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. I think it's Charlie Munger who says, put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket very closely. Very different than the diversification play that you say, that you hear a lot of folks talk about. So Sam, I'm curious your thoughts. You're also a very heavy passive investor and you manage some dollars for some family members as well. What kind of advice would you give to the new or newer passive investor jumping in the space?
So it depends on what their long-term outlook is.
Okay.
If it's someone who's going to go invest $50,000 a year, right? Going deep could make a lot of sense with one partner. If it's someone who may want to be active in the space at some point in the future. So on my end, when I first started, I've now invested in probably 65 LP deals with 15 different sponsors. And the reason I did that is that I knew I wanted in the future to become active in the space. And I knew that getting exposure from different types of groups was not only valuable in terms of each deal serves a different function. So for example, we may invest in one asset class or operator for depreciation. We may invest in, you know, one type of deal for liquidity, one type of deal for cash flow, one type of deal for equity growth.
Yeah.
Because it's each deal solves a different function for a person. So I think it's getting clear as to what you want to do, how involved you want to be, and what your focus is.
Yeah.
And also just how much liquidity are you going to go have to keep allocating to projects. So I think all those play a factor into how you choose to break out your investments.
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to think about too, the amount of capital you have one person will give you the weight with them or not. Right? Everyone says that they treat investors the same way. It's just not true.
It's not.
Right? It's, you know, the bigger you grow, right? Take, for example, Zach, who is not here to speak about this, but they have hundreds of employees at this point between their PM business, between the deals they've active and the corporate staff. So he makes himself very accessible, but he's likely more accessible for people who have eight figures than him versus $50,000.
Sure.
And it's just a matter of life. It happens that way. So I think the more access that you need to feel comfortable, the deeper you should go to that sponsor.
Yeah, both really good points. I think and I think it depends on where the investor is within the cycle of their investing.
Sure.
The new investor, I think it makes a lot of sense to go deep with one operator to really get to understand that. But as you move a larger and larger percentage of your investable capital into the alternative investment space, I think a diversification play can make a lot of sense as well. So, yeah, really good advice. I wasn't expecting the last one that you shared. That's a new take, but something I will implement in my own strategy as well. So let's see if we can shift a little bit about kind of the trends and the economy where we're at, where we're headed, what you guys are considering when you're making decisions for the business. And let's just say in the next 6 to 12 months, because much beyond that, I don't think anybody knows what's going on, but what type of things are you looking at today that are driving your decisions with the assets you're choosing and the strategies that you're using today? So Rob, if you could.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite parts about this business is how dynamic it is. The market's always changing. And right now we find ourselves in a very unique part of the market where prices have come down substantially, but of course rates have gone up substantially. And so things have been shaken up quite a bit. And to the point we were talking about earlier, when you look at a pro forma, it's never going to look bad, right? When you're being pitched a deal. But at the same time, the reverse is true. Most of the time when you're looking at a pro forma, it's going to look average, right? 16% IRR. It's not going to show 25, 40. But we've seen that that's possible. Mm-hmm. And so I think right now, there are going to be some deals that are purchased in 2024 that will dramatically outperform the pro forma and be wrong in the good direction.
Okay.
And it's very hard to do that. It's very hard right now to sit here and go, well, you know, I'm going to buy this deal and it's going to be a 40 IRR because I think cap rates are going to compress 200 basis points.
Sure.
Right? That's not how you look at a pro forma. But I think if you are careful with protecting your downside and you buy the right assets, today is that opportunity. You can't obviously underwrite to it, yeah. But if, like I said, if you're smart and careful, you have the right debt structure in place, those opportunities are there. So that's what we're focused on. We're focused on having the confidence and the courage to invest today, because that's what's lacking. It's not sophistication. It's not good underwriting. It's just, do you have the courage to invest when other people are fearful right now?
I love it. So, Sam, your returns on your current fund, it's amazing when I get the monthly updates. We're exceeding performas by, you know, 40%, 50% sometimes. Obviously, you can't put that in a deck on the front end. But I'm curious, when you're seeing the results that you're seeing today and you're looking at the economy ahead, like, how is that adjusting what you guys are doing with the business?
It's a really big balance.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to go show these astronomical returns that people either, one, believe they're not true, right? I know me personally, I vet deals really frequently to go personally invest in. And if a deal starts with a two in terms of IRR, I usually have a lot of questions.
Sure.
From what level of conservativity, as you know, I'm sure Rob can speak to as well. You change one number, whether that be the exit cap rate in a deal, and that can take it from a 15 to a 25 really quickly.
Yeah.
And it's things that are out of your control. So on our end, we battle that a lot internally, myself and my partner, Seif, as to what do we show to investors, as especially in a newer up and coming asset class, you have to be compensated for the risk you're taking on. We try and structure that by the debt structure and yield rather than the overall return. And something we battle with as to what do we show for overall returns that we feel confident in, but also aren't going to go scare off investors.
Sure.
Or set the bar too high and not leave you any room for error.
Sure.
Something we battle with really frequently. But I think right now, most businesses, and us being included in that, we're more conservative in approach, whether that be the debt structure, whether that be the cash we keep on hand. So we partially view these years not only as, you know, growth, but also making sure that we can go survive long term. I think in this business in general, whether you are an investor or an operator or a sponsor in any way, if you can survive for a very long period of time, you'll end up in a really good spot.
Love it. Love it. Very good. Well, let's kind of shift over to the final few questions here. I like to ask everybody on the show. It's a little bit different, but still want to ask those. I think I've asked both of you these questions, but we'll see if it's changed since the first time we asked. But for the newer passive investor, is there a specific educational resource that you like to direct folks to start their educational journey? So, Sam?
I think go consume as much content as you possibly can. I can speak to when I first started, I had no clue about passive investing. I thought passive investing was buying single family homes, and I quickly realized it was not.
Yep.
And I owned a portfolio of those. And from there, when I realized it was just not what I wanted to do with my time, as my time is better spent in my day job. And every podcast I can go listen to, I listen to, right? Ones like yours, there's other great podcasts out there as well. Listen to those shows and go interview people that you find interesting, right? Go do the, you know, gut check test, like get on the call with them, understand their thesis, what they're working on, and ultimately, do you like this person, right? Yeah. Do you feel comfortable giving them capital? So talk to people, right? Those conversations are free. The podcasts are free to listen to. The YouTube content's free. So go consume a lot of what's out there and go talk to people who are doing it today and get your feel for it and start figuring out what you do and don't want to do.
I love it. And I think that piece you made about liking the person that you're investing with, whether their business plan and their returns are going to provide you what you want, you're going to be dealing with this person likely for 3 to 5 years. So make sure that you like the person that you're dealing with. And I would actually, and maybe it's not the smartest thing, but I would actually make a little bit less, but be able to enjoy the process with the people that I'm working with. I think that's important. So.
Well, also too, every pro forma you look at is wrong. Like every single one, you just hope that they're wrong in the correct direction.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, I also value at this point too, I think it's a little bit different based on kind of where you are in life, is that I'd rather work with and do deals with people I enjoy doing deals with, even if the margin's a bit less, right? That level of trust and credibility and access matters a lot to me. So depending on who you are as a person, those things matter more. But as a past investor, the pro forma's wrong, right? So bet on the people versus the pro forma.
Love it. Rob, you actually have a pretty good resource that you might share with folks and suggest, but I'm curious, anything else?
Yeah, I think to Sam's point, there's just so much content out there. And I think if I were to point to a specific one thing that really stood out to me when I was consuming a lot of content and still do, of course, is Investing in Real Estate Private Equity by Sean Cook. That's a really awesome small book, like my two books.
Sure.
So, you know, I appreciate the no fluff angle. And that book is just jam packed with insights that, you know, frankly, for someone like myself in the business, I might take for granted, but someone approaching the business from a passive side as a beginner can really be eye-opened. And I think that's really, really valuable. And then one other point I would add is there's so much content. This space is so exciting. You know, look at us here at Best Ever. There's such a good energy in the space. And when people get started, I think the mistake that they can make is they get so excited that they invest in the first deal that they see or the first person that slick talks them, right? They invest with that person. And I think the most productive thing a person could do is just have a cooling off period. You're so excited, but just cool off. You know, take time to really understand the situation, because it's incredible as a beginner how different your perspective will be after a month, after 6 months, after 12 months.
Yeah. Right. And my biggest mistake I think I made in my passive investing journey was going big on my first investment with one operator. And I encourage folks, somebody comes to me with X amount of dollars, I'm like, no, let's spread that across three deals. And most capital raisers will take the check with a big smile. But I think in the long run, that's the wrong thing for the investor. And I think it's the wrong thing for the operator as well, quite frankly. So, let's shift a little bit more personal question so folks can get to know you a little bit better. Can you share a recent bucket list item you've checked off your list, or one you hope to in the near future? Sam.
Oof. I think a big one, this wasn't that recent, it's a little over a year and a half ago. So leaving the corporate job was a big one. And I can definitely go talk about travel. I love to go travel, see new places, eat in nice restaurants. But I think the big one was the independence from the corporate job. And it was a very good corporate job. Like it was a mid to high six figure type role, which most people, you know, youngest person on my team leadership wise by 15 years on the executive team. And it's something most people work years and years and decades for. And I think the ability of saying, you know, hey, I appreciate the opportunity here, but I need to do something on my own was really valuable. I think people, if you have that entrepreneurial itch and you want to go do your own thing at some point, no matter money agnostic, right? You need to do something for yourself.
Yeah.
So for me, that freedom piece of it allows you just clarity in thought and peace of mind. And in turn, I now have way less things in my calendar that I look at and I dread doing. So I think the world's a better place collectively. People are working on things they're excited and passionate about. They can go give back to those communities, help in those ways, and just get clarity on what they want to do. So last piece of advice too is people is like, figure out what you really don't want to do, and what you want to do becomes a lot more clear.
I love that. I love that. And I think you're the perfect example of the high-income W-2 person that was able to step away because of what you were able to do in the passive investing space. So great example, great advice as well. And that single bucket list item, I'm sure, is what opened the door for many, many more bucket list items since leaving about a year and a half, or whatever that time frame was.
Yeah, right? the flexibility of time, too. I think it's also too important. Like, you can then go build who you want to go work with, right? Like, I just currently am hiring my best friend to work with me in a company I started recently, too, right? So, like, things like that. I know, Rob, you recently hired and brought on Craig, right? One of your really close friends, too. So those things that you get to go do, you get to go spend more time with people you want to go work with.
Yeah. Love it. Love it.
Yeah, life's too short. Yeah, well, really simple answer. Future bucket list item for Sam and I is we want to go to Japan.
Okay.
That's there's not many trips on my list that I'm excited about. Most of my travel is for work, and then I maybe will wrap around some leisure around that. You know, we just went to Sedona after RaceFest in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Super amazing experience. But yeah, I think Japan is a big one that we need to do.
Love it. Love it. We heard some of the old bucket list last night at dinner as well. So that's
Mykonos.
Yeah. We'll keep that to us here anyway. So, all right. And then the final question I like to ask everybody, and this is actually new. If you had, let's change it up a little bit. If you had $100,000 that you had to invest before you left the conference and you couldn't invest it in either one of these two operators, where would you place that capital? Sam?
For me, probably the mobile home park space.
Okay.
Strictly for tax purposes. So if you go qualify for REP status for tax purposes, you can go, there's much more depreciation in that than any other asset class right now that I have looked at personally. So I'd say the mobile home parks or going to hire really good people.
Okay. Any particular operator you like in the space?
There's
not that you're giving advice, but
there's definitely a handful that I've had good experiences with. That the issue there, honestly, is just overall deal flow, right? The one of the big benefits is that space is that the deals are smaller. Most are sub $10 million. And you're buying from very unsophisticated sellers. Remember one we actually bought last year? The seller's financials were on loose leaf paper in a bucket. And so deals you can go find quality basis on that are truly off-market, unsophisticated seller have a lot of value. But I think all the other side of it too is if you're building a company and growing, investing into really good people will pay you back in a massive way in terms of bringing on people to go move things off your plate or allow you to go focus on other things as well.
Love it. Love a good point. Rob?
Well, my first answer is a little bit of a cheat answer, but it's still a good one. And that would be if I'm in a scramble and I need to put money somewhere today, it would be in passive investing's hard money fund or something similar. That's just what I've chosen to do most recently. But I know you're working with DLP, and I think their offering is similar, and also they have a great reputation. So yeah, I think right now especially, there's a ton of value in liquid real estate debt funds. Because why? Because of the strong yield that they provide. Also the liquidity. Liquidity is super valuable because at any moment we might come upon a unicorn type deal like I was just talking about earlier, and you're going to want to take that liquidity and pump it into that unicorn deal. But in the meantime, it's really great to earn 8, 9, 10, 12%. And the downside, of course, of real estate debt funds are the tax benefits. There are none, right? It's actually just interest income. And then the other thing is there's no growth there. So for me as an investor, right, I'm young, I don't need cash flow today. I want to grow my wealth over time. So for me, no growth is not attractive on a long-term basis. So I know that money needs to go somewhere eventually, but if I'm in a scramble, it's going to go into a liquid debt fund. And then on a longer-term basis, someone who is a partner of ours, just like you, is Flagship Capital. Mm-hmm. And they're here, and I respect them a ton. They've been in the business forever, and they seem to always uncover unique deals. They're all over the country. Somehow they just, even though they're macro, they're micro, right?
Okay.
They'll know the one broker in this market or what have you. So
sure.
I love what they do, and they invest both in debt and equity. So I love that flexibility. So I don't think they would take my $100,000 check into their fund, but I would find my way in.
Very good. Very good. Well, this has been a lot of fun, guys, to kind of hear kind of not conflicting strategies, but different strategies and different asset classes and different business plans. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience or how they can find you if they wanted to hear more about what it is that you're offering?
Yeah. So for me, super active on LinkedIn, probably the easiest place to get a hold of me, Sam Silverman. Really active there in terms of posting, responding there. So, or the Fully Funded Show. We recently launched our podcast. You can go hear both Randy and Rob, one of our first two episodes. So, yeah.
Very good. Very good. Rob?
Good stuff. Yeah, if you want to learn more about what we do at Lone Star, please check out our website, lscre.com. On our website, we have a ton of resources. We have the books that I've written. We have a ton of articles, webinars, and, of course, some free downloads, our past investor guide, as well as our underwriting model that we use every day to analyze our potential acquisitions.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate the time today. And to the audience, thank you for listening today to The Gentle Art of Crushing It. As always, we suggest that you continue the education process, but more importantly than that, make the decision to invest in your first passive investing deal. We are sure that once you do, you will be so happy that you did and wish you had just started sooner. So again, wrapping up here from the pre-iShare sponsored booth, podcast booth here at the Best Ever Conference. Thanks so much for listening today and join us again next Thursday for another great episode.
Are you interested in real estate investing but don't know where to get started or think you don't have the time or money? Are you stuck in your W-2 because the golden handcuffs make it hard to walk away? If this sounds like you, check out impactequity.net and schedule some time to talk with the founder, Randy Smith. Randy went from massive income to leaving his W-2 through passive income, and he can help you do the same. www.impactequity.net.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, another episode of The Gentle Art of Crushing It. It was an amazing episode. We know we sure learned a lot, and we hope you did as well. We want to take a second and thank you so much for viewing or listening to this episode. And please just know that we only ask for one favor, and that is to make this life magnificent. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.